Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Jeet here, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, father of the Twitter essay, comics historian. Welcome to Shortcuts.
Good to be here.
Today on the show, from the hothouse flowers of journalism school to the slaughterhouse cattle of the journalism business, we will talk about the carnage at Ryerson University and at HuffPost Canada. Also, if you were surprised to learn that Dr. Seuss was racist, wait till you hear about Mickey Mouse. Glad to have you here.
Good to be here.
Today's episode of Shortcuts is brought to everybody by Tal Bognikov, Sarah Craggs, Liam Flagg, Julia Anderson, Lisa Silvestre, Nikita Urazbiev, Alyssa Frampton, and Michael.
Hi, my name is Michael Chapman. I'm an anti-corruption crusader. I support Canada Land because I want to live in a country where truth speaks to power and where small stories have a huge importance.
Okay, Jeet, big shakeup at Ryerson School of Journalism. We don't typically cover the politics of J schools, but this drama, I think, requires some attention. Here's what the Toronto Star's Brendan Kennedy reported this week. The heads of Ryerson's journalism school resigned Sunday, just hours before a group of current and former students released an open letter accusing the school of fostering, quote, unsafe learning environment, end quote, and failing to support racialized and LGBTQ students. Jeet, did you read this open letter?
I have read the open letter, and I've been following the story the way a newsreader would. Like, I've never gone to any J school, let alone Ryerson, so I'm talking about this at some distance.
Well, you know, this show, we're just like reading the stuff as newsreaders and trying to make sense of it. As a newsreader reading the open letter, what did you make of it?
I thought the letter brought up a lot of things that are like really major concerns, not just for students, but I think for journalists, that like the media is been going through a lot of contest and contestation and battles over issues of trauma and representation. And I don't think it's surprising that if this is what's happening in the newsrooms, it would also be happening in J school. So I think that the larger frame that we have to take is a kind of economic and social one, which is that journalism is in a longstanding sort of economic crisis where a lot of older business models have failed, are failing. There's not a lot of job security. You know, as Gramsci famously said, the old world is dying. The new world is struggling to be born. Now is the time of monsters. So we are, as was Gramsci, living in the time of monsters. I think a lot of that turmoil feeds into these kind of newsroom battles where you have a cohort, you know, people who are entering into a newsroom culture that's very different than the one that management has experienced. People who are in management came of age at a time when, you know, like it was a much more flourishing industry, but also a much less diverse industry. At a basic level, I think that the complaints can be understood as young people who know that they're going into an industry that is very different than what they're being trained for. It's as if our military schools were run by cavalry officers. And these might be good cavalry officers who know how to lead a horse charge. But, you know, if you're living in an age of guerrilla warfare, that's not, you know, the best people to train you.
I want to return to this idea that is fundamentally what the students are requesting is better training for the actual industry that exists. That's an open question we'll return to. But you're engaging with this in a very like big thinker point of view. I'm a little thinker. I just want to know what happened. Something prompted this letter, which really is an effort to chronicle years of complaint and issues and, yeah, and systemic, yeah, racism and specific incidents, some very serious allegations, teachers harassing students. But a lot of it is like, you don't know when it happened. You don't know who did it. And it runs the gamut from like very serious accusations of racism to like some of the testimonials read to me a bit like school was really hard and it stressed me out and I didn't get adequate help from faculty. Opening up a question as to like, to what degree is it faculty's role? But like, you know, there's a big spectrum of complaint and there's a lack of specificity. Like there's very few names of who the perpetrators of these things are.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering as a newsreader, why was this letter published now? And then the aftermath of the letter that students accused Ryerson J School of systemic institutionalized racism, and then Janice Neal and Lisa Taylor, the two people who run the program, stepped down. I think people could be, you know, excused for drawing a conclusion that they are accepting that there is validity to this charge of racism and that, like, I guess we're responsible for this racism, so we're stepping down. As I looked into this a little bit, and actually as the Star looked into it, because her story was updated, there is a backstory here, and I'd like to share it with you.
Sure.
So listeners of Shortcuts might remember me talking about Jonathan Bradley, young aspiring journalist, Ryerson J School student, worked for one of the papers there, The Eye Opener, and also writes for The Post-Millennial, and devout Catholic. And I think to make a long story short, he found himself, well, I think he was an active agent who got in a big conflict with his fellow students. Some of it you kind of had to feel for him because a private Twitter conversation in which he revealed that he takes an interpretation of the Bible that homosexuality is a sin, those private messages were publicly shared, which, you know, confirmed people's suspicions of him that he's this homophobe, but also I think was a gross transgression of his privacy. But it was a bit of a moot point because it turns out that he tweeted that stuff publicly once as well. So here they are with this, you know, kind of like out there. Yes, my Christianity means that being gay is a sin. So he's a homophobe. And the fellow students are like, what are we going to do with this guy? He launches a human rights complaint that as for his religious beliefs, he's being unfairly ostracized and shut out of his job at this newspaper. And this just becomes a huge issue at the school because the school has responsibilities to him as a student,
sure,
and yet they have responsibilities to the rest of the students as well. And what came to a head is that students were piling on Jonathan Bradley, some of them with like kind of funny stuff saying like, hey, every time you launch a human rights complaint, I'm going to kiss a girl, as one female student put it. But other people actually made accusations about him, allegations and allegedly defamatory comments about Jonathan Bradley. And Bradley said, take that down. That's defamation. We have defamation law. And if you don't remove that tweet, I will sue you for defamation. And the students then went to faculty and said, he's making us feel unsafe because he's threatening us with lawsuits.
Yeah.
And that led to a usually these like meetings of the student governance with J School at Ryerson have like, you know, a few people show up. This time, almost 100 people showed up to this public Zoom call meeting last month. And this is where the students, like the big issue of the day was, what is faculty going to do about Jonathan Bradley? Let's hear a little bit of that.
It says a lot that a student in our faculty in the School of Journalism is threatening the livelihoods of journalism students. It's threatening them through income and using it to intimidate them to take down their opinions on social media. To me, I feel unsafe hearing that. It makes me feel unsafe because my opinions as a student are not valued or heard by this individual. And he's threatening students doing that. So it's creating a community that is feeling unsafe.
And it's kind of disheartening that we're seeing someone still kind of have a voice that's like negatively affecting us and how we feel in RSJ. So I just thought you guys should like know that on behalf of the first year students.
Just seems like it could set a very dangerous precedent for what RSJ will and will not tolerate.
What capacity does RSJ have to reprimand them?
Please don't do this to your future student again, please.
I'm asking you to answer as the ally you claim you are to the students. What are you going to do to make RSJ a safe space for students?
When I hear you say that you're in third year and you have not felt safe at any time in our program, that you have felt attacked, I stopped breathing. The fact that I'm hearing that in your sixth semester here is alarming to me.
You could hear there Janice Neal talking about how she takes some responsibility. It feels terrible for her to learn that students are unsafe. Lisa Taylor remarked that, you know, if students don't feel that she's in their corner, then yes, she's got to go. They're staying at the school as instructors, by the way, but they have left their positions running the J school. What do you make of that?
There's like a whole bunch of different separate issues, one of which is that I think the rights talk makes it very hard for people to compromise. But we see that on both corners with both making the human rights complaints and then using this language of safety. But again, I think I would emphasize that, this is not a unique to Ryerson situation. We're kind of seeing this, the very same issues playing out in newsrooms. And some of that is just it's an outgrowth of therapeutic culture, which has given people vocabulary for talking about this sort of distress, which also has genuine roots. I mean, it is the case that we're much more aware of trauma. Some of my conservative friends have a natural reaction to this of saying, well, it's a kind of, religious guilt language of the expiation of sins, and it reinforces people's conditions. But a language of trauma comes from the fact that people are actually traumatized, and we've developed ways to talk about this. But it's also, I have to go back to this. It's people who are in a kind of precarious situation. And I think that precariousness governs everything. There's an instability to this institution. I mean, for me, the biggest question is, is it even ethical to have J school?
That's a good question. Why would it be unethical to have J school? I'm curious how you take that.
Okay, I'm a teacher. Would it be ethical for me to take money from students for them to go in a profession where I know they might not find a job? In fact, statistically are likely to end up in something else like public relations. But it's also in an industry that's in such deep distress that they're going to be experiencing a lot of financial hardship, but also the sort of emotional and psychological hardship. Can you honestly take money from people to send them into that? I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying everyone in J school should resign and become a cobbler. But I mean, it's something that I think that, people should ask themselves.
I felt that for a long time. Look, you can study anything. You can study all kinds of things that don't equip you to make money. You can study ancient Sanskrit. You can, but if you're going to have a vocational training program with internships and leading into the industry, at what point are you just stealing money from people when there is no industry for them to, to graduate into? I'm of two minds about this stuff, right? On the one hand, I have the kind of a grumbly old man reaction. It would never have occurred to me in a million years that my professors were responsible for my mental health, or that if I encountered an offensive idea in school, that was the fault of my professors or something, But again, I was not a racialized student, dealing with systemic racism. When you hear these students turn to faculty and talking about you're asking us to cover a lot of traumatic things here, I'm like, well, that is good training for journalism, and actually having higher ups who are indifferent to your suffering, because you just got to get the job done. A lot of this was people saying I had a loved one die and you didn't give me time off school or things like that. Those are among the complaints. I'm like, how is this person going to function in this really tough business?
Yeah.
And should the school, like at school, you're a customer, you know, you're not a customer when you work in a media company. Like media management will often like make some noises about, you know, yeah, we want to make this a good environment. We want everybody to be healthy here, but ultimately they're businesses and they don't owe the employees the same things that like, you know, the money comes from the students in a school.
Well, that is another factor that this sort of consumer model of education does lead to these complaints. But I mean, I just also think of it in generational terms, which is that the people who are in their late teens, 20s, and 30s, they know that the world that they're getting is not the world that older people have gotten. They're not going to get, you know, the good steady jobs for 20 years. They're not going to get the pension. And to be honest, like, you know, when they're my age or older, you know, they're going to inherit a doomed planet that is going to be in its death knell. So the fact that they have decided to focus within those conditions on emphasizing like mental health and wellness, like kind of makes sense.
It does. And you can actually feel like, well, why should they just accept the way things are? Why shouldn't they demand these things? That actually is really good. Maybe we can change things if that's the case, you know?
The core existential fact is we're talking about people who are screwed. They're screwed as a generation and they're screwed as people entering into this, you know, very precarious profession. This is the strategy that has people are cobbling together to deal with this. Now, one could say, you know, there are other approaches to take, which would include a more materialist approach. And that's my politics, right? Like my own politics is to prefer to say like, well, you guys try to start a union. But I don't think that even if you're a hardcore materialist, which I am, or a historical materialist, like you have to acknowledge people's existential psychological issues, which is a part of material reality as well.
But the material outcome of this strategy was pretty imperfect because the faculty that stepped down who were not accused of anything, you know, like now somebody else has got to come in and, you know, try to clean up what's going on there. The faculty that just left actually improved the representation of people of color and other marginalized groups in faculty, like from like 11% of Ryerson J School faculty to like 30%. They met demands for a course on Black Lives Matter. They were a very responsive faculty by some measures to these types of demands from students. Now they're out. And it's kind of ugly. Like, are they out because they're like, yeah, we didn't do a good job? Or are they out because like, why should they answer for, like, somebody needs to tell these students defamation law and the law around speech is what allows us to function as journalists. We can't protect you from making an error and perhaps defaming someone, and then they threaten to sue you. That's a very good lesson for you as a future journalist.
Yeah, yeah.
We all speak in the same legal regimen whereby the rules are anyone can sue anyone. So be careful what you say. We have no purview to remove this person's right to sue you or to threaten to sue you. Like, those are good lessons, you know?
They are good lessons. But I mean, I would just note, like, going to like the Human Rights Commission itself is kind of a red flag of a kind of trollish character.
Oh, agreed. Agreed.
And I do think that there is a legitimate kind of issue here that there are these moral absolutes that are very hard to negotiate. Now, liberalism has traditionally tried to move these absolute issues into the realm of process and so to take them out of like political contestation. But at some issue, like if you have someone who believes that, you know, like, homosexuals are inherently sinful, how does that person fit into like an environment where there are openly out people? And one sees this like in a lot of like legal court cases. One approach is the American right approach, which is to prioritize religious freedom and to say that, you know, if you bake a cake and don't want to sell to a gay wedding, that's your religious freedom. That's your freedom of expression. These are issues that are very hard to negotiate because they are in these absolute moral terms. I mean, I don't blame either the students or the Ryerson faculty that they have a hard time coming up with any sort of balance because no one has.
Maybe impossible, but I think that the way that we've worked it out in liberal societies is just like a certain sense of like tolerance in that, like, yes, you are going to go out into the world and be surrounded by people who have aberrant attitudes and opinions. And, you know, nobody should like agree to be dehumanized. But I don't know what they can do about this guy's religious beliefs.
Although I do think that kind of politicized religiosity, which is not really rooted in religious teaching, tries to like troll on these issues. I don't want to hold any judgment about the behavior of the Ryerson faculty to this, except to note that these are very hard issues. But I mean, you're saying like, well, the students are going to find a hard time in the world of journalism. I think that's true. But I also would emphasize that a lot of these battles are in fact being fought out in actual newsrooms. Maybe not so much in Canada, but like I think in America, we've seen many newsrooms where there's been a kind of revolt of young staff against older management.
Yeah, and a lot of it is long overdue, and it's happening most robustly in, you know, solvent newsrooms like the New York Times. It can't happen in a newsroom that itself gets canceled. You want to talk about cancel culture? Let's talk about HuffPost Canada. I noted that one of the people providing a testimonial, journalist Al Donato, former Ryerson student, is one of the casualties of Huffington Post Canada just having the lights shut out. And to tell people who haven't heard what happened, you know, after like, you know, more or less of a decade-long run here, HuffPost Canada was part of, you know, there was all of these digital brands coming in, Vice Canada, BuzzFeed set up Canada, and like, oh, maybe this is where things are going to move, you know? Maybe we'll have these big American tech companies, tech journalism companies set up their Canadian bureaus, and that's the future of Canadian journalism. Well, they were acquired by BuzzFeed. Then HuffPost Canada said that they were going to be unionizing. And then the way that this played out was pretty awful. Employees were called to a Zoom meeting. The password was "Spring is here," which sounds very nice and inviting. And at that Zoom meeting, they were told that 47 of them would be laid off. You'll only know if you still have a job if you don't receive an email by one. And the layoffs included the entirety of HuffPost Canada, including management, gone. How did you describe that, Jeet?
Well, I think it's sociopathic behavior, like just how they handle. I mean, like, obviously, if a company is making a go of it, they will close up shop. But the way they handled it, I don't think you should treat humans like that. The broader issue, I think, is that there was a model here that was never a very viable model. Like, none of these companies, I think, ever really came close to profitability, but there was always another sucker. Like, there was always another investor that you could bring in there. You could tread water. And like at a certain point, you know, like you can't anymore. And there's a kind of monopolistic urge as well. Like I think BuzzFeed buying up their competitor, well, you know what happens when like you buy up your competitor, right?
Yeah. Synergy is happening.
That's right. Yeah. It's very sad. There's a lot of incredibly talented people who did really good work. HuffPost in the United States as well. At some point, you have some profitable companies like New York Times and the Washington Post, but these are like arcs, right? And how much can you hold on an arc? Well, typically like two of each animal, right? Like, but I don't know. I mean, like the floods are here, man.
Yeah.
What boats are we building?
To me, this is the death knell for, you know, like Vice Canada is a shell of what it was. BuzzFeed Canada doesn't really exist. They retained some employees and folded them into BuzzFeed. Yes. There is no like specific Canadian operation. To me, what this says is the death of that promise that these models of like these tech companies from like 10, 15 years ago, or these media companies rather from 10, 15 years ago that were treated almost like, you know, buzzy hot tech startups. And as such, were speculated on, were gobbled up by this company, then traded to that company. And the idea was that that kind of capitalism and, you know, venture capitalism and that kind of consolidation could be applied to the news business. Error, you know, wrong. There may be a viable solvent way forward for media. I think it's on a much, on a micro scale. I think that this is like, let's learn a lesson from this and, you know, let's pour out some liquor for everybody who did good work at HuffPost Canada. I remember when they were like the big bad, oh, HuffPost is going to aggregate the real journalists out of existence. Well, the legacy stuff isn't working and neither is the aggregation stuff anymore. And neither is the speculation stuff. I just keep waiting for this business to just fucking humble itself and realize it can be done on a micro scale. It's not sexy anymore. It's like opening a barber shop. It's like opening a little bistro on the corner. It's like opening a convenience store. If you know, if you can keep your nut low and provide a little bit of journalism for your block or for your beat, you may be able to eke out a living. And let's pay ourselves. Jeet, we duly note stories that deserve wider attention. What do you have?
I just did a column on The Nation about this, but there's this thing called the Lincoln Project. They were these former Republicans, you know, people who'd work for John McCain and Mitt Romney, who said that we are opposed to Trump. And they raised a ton of money, like $87 million to do these anti-Trump ads. And they got a lot of boasts from a lot of liberals at like, you know, Mother Jones and other places that are saying these guys are great. They're heroes. And the New York Times had a great expose, just like what incredible grifters these guys were, where, like, you know, they paid themselves like tens of millions of dollars. They had contractors who were put on the board. So people they're paying money to are also getting like money on the board. And they got kickbacks from like all the people they're paying money to. And these guys, I mean, talking about business models, you know, they were thinking of taking this $80 million company and becoming a billion-dollar media company. And what has unraveled them is that, like, one of them turned out to be a sexual predator. And the Times has found, you know, more than 20 men who have said, like, he has done very inappropriate things, including someone who was as young as 14. So the flip side of what we're talking about, the economic problems, is that this is really an age of grifters and of mountebanks and charlatans and scam artists. And these guys are at the top of the profession.
Duly noted. I would like to duly note some of the International Women's Day fails. Hershey's. Get it?
Yeah. Dad joke.
Well, they're not done yet. I'm her she. They also had to offer. Yes. Thank you. That's great, Hershey's. Burger King. Women belong in the kitchen, tweets Burger King UK, followed up by, if they want to, of course, yet only 20% of chefs are women. That's a good one, Burger King. They belong in the kitchen, but you're actually on the side of the women if they want to be professional chefs. Way to go, Burger King. Deleted that tweet. And then a bit closer to home, we have our Canadian journalist. It's been pointed out how many journalists like took International Women's Day as an opportunity to say, like, thanks to all the women in my life who like help clean up. And like, it's just a strange flex. And when Evan Solomon was thanking the powerful and brilliant women in his life, Globe and Mail's Robert Fife said, and your producers who make you look smart on radio and TV, all women. So let's, thanks. One for the ladies from Fife. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world. And it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing. And it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope.
If it could happen to Dr. Seuss, it might happen to you. Dr. Seuss went from being a beloved childhood author to worse than Hitler in just a matter of days.
So, Gene, I'm sure that you heard about this already, but last week, the business that now runs the Dr. Seuss brand, it's not the Seuss family, the rights were sold to a business, they announced that they are going to stop publishing 6 different books because, quote, they portray people in ways that are hurtful and wrong. And a bunch of, I think, lesser titles that I'm aware of, like Mulberry Street, because I think it was his first, but the rest of them, I don't know. I didn't really even know about these books. Mm-hmm. They're going out of print, and people lost their fucking minds as if Dr. Seuss is being canceled. you and I both like cartoons, but you actually are kind of a scholar of comics and cartoons. First of all, have you ever read any of these out-of-print Dr. Seuss books to your kids?
I think I read to myself Mulberry Street. But no, these are not. We have a lot of Dr. Seuss in our house, but we have not had those. These are, in general, lesser-known titles. It's a very strange argument to make that, like, a publisher taking books out of print is censorship, because publishers do that all the time.
I mean, that's, I think, the obvious stupidity of the rage. This is not canceling Dr. Seuss. This is not censorship or banning of Dr. Seuss. In fact, it's not even like a moral decision, I don't think, from the publisher. And there really are some pretty damn racist depictions in some of these books, which is like totally normal for cartooning at that time, not to excuse it, but like not terribly surprising. I think they're just protecting the Dr. Seuss brand. And it kind of backfired because that gave people like occasion to go through some of Dr. Seuss's early editorial cartoons, which are gruesomely racist, ghastly and horrifically racist. So it was not good for the Seuss brand.
Okay, so there's a bunch of different issues kind of at play. One is the sort of, you know, history of cartooning and children's books and the way things change. Let's start from the first fact. Dr. Seuss wrote and drew books for kids, right? Now, one could take a totally free speech approach, as I do. Like, I have like Robert Crumb and Nabokov and Desaad on my bookshelf, but I'm not reading them to like my 6-year-old, right? like you do make a, I think people should make a distinction between what's appropriate for adults and what's appropriate for kids. And actually, as you're right, I've edited many books on old cartoons, which include a lot of racist imagery. Now children's books change a lot, because people's attitudes of what's acceptable to children change a lot. If you go through the classics of 19th century German kids' literature, you will find characters that are gouging out people's eyes, and like kids that are sucking their thumb, and the guy who has scissors for hands, the original Edward Scissorhand, who like, you know, chops off their thumbs. I would not read those to my kids, right? Would you? I don't know.
No. I mean, you know, there's Brothers Grimm stories where like the raven crows to the children, don't go into that house. A Jew lives there. Like, you know, that was the cautionary tale of the Brothers Grimm. And there's something specific when we're talking about cartoons.
That's the other thing with Dr. Seuss, with Theodore Gazelle. He's originally a cartoonist, and he came out of newspaper comics. He actually did a newspaper comic in the 30s, Hadji, which is kind of like a Arabian Nights thing, which probably also should not be read to kids these days. But the early 20th century newspaper comics and animated cartoons really came out of like vaudeville and the minstrel show. Like virtually all the cartoonists of that era did vaudeville and did minstrelry, including ironically like George Harriman, who was an African American cartoonist who passed for white, but then like, you know, with his white cartoonists, if they did minstrel shows, he also blackface. So there was like a black man pretending to be white, pretending to be black.
An incredible cartoonist, Crazy Cat and Ignatz by Herman. And it goes on and on.
And the interesting thing is that a lot of these cartoonists brought in that minstrel show imagery, but also like animal imagery, and mixed it all together. And like when, if you look at someone like Mickey Mouse, that's coming out of anthropomorphic animals. And also the jazz singer, right? Like Mickey with the white gloves and the kind of if you take off the ears, it's exactly a minstrel show image, which of the type that Justin Trudeau loves so much.
So, Jeet, tell me if my history is correct, because you've studied this in a bit more of a scholarly fashion than I have. I'm just a fan, but it was fascinating to me to go to you know, being a fan of comics and tracing it back, to realize like it's not just that like, okay, people were racist back then and it crept into comics. You cannot extract racism from cartooning and comics any more than you can extract it from the history of America. So you got Mickey Mouse, as you say, like, and I look at like Bimbo the dog and like these, you know, you point out the white gloves, but this is like a Sambo character. You know, Winsor McCay, who is the father of animation and did these beautiful Little Nemo, which is filled with racist stuff. He was a vaudeville performer who would bring his Gertie the Dinosaur onto the stage. So like minstrelsy and blackface and cartoons and comics, as you say, it's all interlinked. Mickey Mouse, American as apple pie, is kind of like this, like, it's interesting to me. It's really complicated stuff, because the Fleischer brothers, who had Bimbo the dog and Betty Boop, They did some really racist cartoons, you know? Yes. And it's a lot easier to see the blackface connection in those cartoons. Mm-hmm. And then you've got like the floating head of like Louis Armstrong as a cannibal. It's horrible stuff. Mm-hmm. And yet the Fleischer brothers were these like New York Jewish cartoonists doing really funny, racy cartoons. And this was Louis Armstrong's first screen appearance. He was collaborating with these jazz cartoons. Like this was like a way in which a lot of jazz culture made it to the mainstream. And then Disney goes and whitewashes that all, and it's not as apparent with Mickey Mouse that this is a minstrel character, and his team are all farm boys, and the humor is all farm boy humor, and Walt Disney's a crazy racist.
There's a lot of complication. I mean, even like within blackface, I mean, you had black entertainers like, you know, Brick Williams or Sammy Davis Jr., you know, who performed in that way. And in some ways, it was a way in which the broader white America, that was the only grounds on which they were able to listen to black music, and was a way in which black music became American music. And so it's like hugely important. This is how, you know, American culture was made. And it's like totally tied up with these kind of like racial imagery. But they're very ambiguous as well. I mean, like, I think a lot of people who study this stuff will emphasize that there's like ways in which like, there's a benign aspect of emphasizing creativity, freedom. Think of Mickey Mouse, right? Like he's a kind of, you know, jolly spirited guy, and that these minstrel characters had a liveliness that was not allowed to the white characters. But still very complicated, and it's all in there, and which is why I don't like the fact that these books are now going to be out of print for brand management's sake. My solution is to have Dr. Seuss, but only for adults. Have scholarly archival editions that, like, you know, explain the historical context, explain the importance, and keep those books in print. Now, the real problem is copyright, right? Like, you have this thing, the Gazelle Estate, which is not connected to the family, was actually, I think, owned by Random House, and they're acting like Disney. Like, they have this brand that they want to protect. And actually, I think that they actually did work out well for them, because they got rid of the books that displeased librarians and refurbished the brand. And then also, everyone's worried that Dr. Seuss is going to disappear. So, like, 30 of the top 50 books on Amazon earlier this week were Dr. Seuss. Like, they're selling a ton of books.
They are, but they reminded Twitter not just of those anti-Japanese cartoons, but there's earlier anti-black stuff by Seuss that's very much, you won't be seeing that at the Seuss theme park in Florida.
Well, actually, I think there's a Seuss library, and the way actually they do it is they have a room with this sort of stuff, which is for adults only, right? Like, I think that is the solution. Like, I don't want this stuff eradicated from history. Like, I actually think it's important to know the history. The history of this stuff is the history of America. Like, you cannot understand American culture without understanding this stuff.
That's absolutely true.
I actually honestly think that the sort of copyright hold and these, like, crazy copyright laws, which are actually come out of Mickey Mouse and Disney and their corporate power, really makes it difficult to have proper conversations and leads to a situation where it's all or nothing. And, you know, you have like Toronto Sun type demagogues taking advantage of the conversation. So I really feel like it's an unhealthy situation. But again, historical materialist that I am, I want to emphasize the role of corporate power here as really like setting the terms by which these things are debated. And I don't think that a company that has nothing to do with the Seuss family should be making these decisions for books that are nearly 100 years old.
We do not like it with a mouse. No, I'm sorry. I won't. Thanks, Jeet.
Okay, thank you.
That's your Canada Land Shortcuts, everybody. You can email me about it. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. I read what you send me. And we're on Twitter at Canada Land. Where can people find you, Jeet?
On Twitter at herejeet.com. I am at The Nation magazine, where I'm a regular columnist. And to maybe offer your listeners a promise, there's, I think, a very exciting venture that I'm going to be starting up later in the summer.
All right. We need more of those. We're looking for that. Our website is canadaland.com. This episode is produced by Tiffany Lamb, with additional production by Kevin Sexton. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt, and our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we do, you should support what we do, and we'll give you stuff. It's as simple as that. Just click on the link in the show notes or go to canadaland.com/join to support this independent journalism company right here in Canada. Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.